Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
What's happening?
Hello, boss. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I was having a think to myself earlier on, and I try and avoid labeling anything that I do a job because my whole life has really been a commitment to avoiding getting a job. But in some instances, I think you really have to go, well, this is a job because it's, you know, it's work, it's enjoyable, but there's thought and there's structure and there's craft involved. And with this, you know, latest project, which I've begun to undertake, it's very much a job. And if it is a job, then you, good sir, would be considered my boss. And I thought, how lucky am I, A, not just to have a boss like you, but B, to be able to be in a position where I can interview my boss. How many people can say that? Turn the table around.
Well, I got to be honest with you, that it does make me feel uncomfortable and honored at the same time. I have staff that refer to me as my boss and as their boss. And I just, you know, I just think of myself as a colleague most of the time, unless the hammer needs to come down. But, you know, we do what we do.
Well, it's interesting for me because I haven't had a real job now since I was about 19. So we're talking 15 years. And everybody that I do work with, and indeed in some cases for, are my friends. I've been really lucky that I've gotten to really pick who I work with and for, and everybody that I now refer to as a boss, I use that term as a term of endearment for me. It was funny because when I grew up, I used to hate all my bosses. And it was strange because I always got on with teachers and with lecturers, and I always got on with friends' parents and girlfriends' parents. So I've never had a problem with elders. If anything, I look up to and respect and always want to learn from people that are older than me. But there's something about the workplace that, I don't know, for me, just made me resent the person in power. And I don't know whether that would have been the same for you at all, because, you know, I'm reading through the amazing story of your personal life, your professional journey, and it seems, like me, to be characterized by this kind of Renaissance man approach to wanting to take on multiple roles in multiple universes and bring various strands together, but also really to kind of be the master of your own destiny and carve out your own path. Would that be safe to say? And choose who you work with by default as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, for better or worse, yeah, I do have a bit of an anti-authoritarian bent to my personality. I think in some ways that's probably an asset, and others it tends to get me in trouble. You know, the longer that we function as a company, and the longer that I act as a person in charge of a company and have employees and work with different people, you know, I can't help but think that it would be terrorizing to have me 20 years ago as an employee now.
I love it. Well, I mean, what an amazing background. And I want to go first of all to the kind of early years in Minneapolis, which, you know, I guess most people will know as the home, musically speaking, of Prince. And I've just been informed by these, you know, thorough and thoroughly interesting notes that you sent through to me that your brother, right, was in a band who recorded out at Paisley Park, Prince's like home studio compound.
Yeah, yeah. I have two older stepbrothers, Joel Hansen and Jade Hansen, that are 12 and 13 years older than me. And they did a lot of recording. I mean, they're like born again Christian pop musicians. But, you know, that whole scene in Minneapolis was very much intertwined with the Prince camp.
Is that just because he's so, or was so larger than life, like it's almost inescapable?
Yeah, I think that there's an aspect of him being omniscient in the area. But, you know, he was, I didn't know Prince personally, but from my interactions and from people around me, you know, he just seemed like a great community figure that liked to contribute and bring a lot of great people along for the ride.
I can't remember the exact details, but Bob Mould is from Minneapolis, right?
He is. Well, he's from New York, actually, but he moved to Minneapolis, St. Paul to go to university,
right,
if I remember correctly.
Because when Prince passed, there was all these different tributes from different people. And there was one, I can't remember the exact details of it, but I'm sure if people just Googled it, a beautiful, touching, kind of quite funny tribute from Bob Mould saying about experiences he'd had with Prince. And then obviously the other huge musical, well, I don't know whether huge would be the right term, but certainly important in the underground world, and a band that I've always adored as just one of those stepping stone bands, I think, between hardcore and then grunge. And there's a few of those kind of bands, because I think people who don't know about the history of American music will maybe think that bands like Nirvana just arrived from out of nowhere and exploded. But obviously the story is it goes back to the hardcore scene, doesn't it? And, you know, bands like The Replacements would have been, for me, and maybe you could agree or disagree or shed some light on that, a key stepping stone in that evolution from the kind of basement hardcore underground DIY nitty gritty punk rock roots music to then, you know, the world conquering internationally successful bands like Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, etc. They were like the through line, weren't they? Bands like Husker Du, Replacements, Meat Puppets.
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I mean, that was a little bit before my time, but the influence is obviously very prevalent. I love all those bands and grew up listening to them. I worked on a book with Grant Hart from Husker Du for a number of years before he died. Hopefully that project still comes out. And, you know, it's just a great legacy of Minneapolis, among many other things that I think, you know, I think some people realize it when they think of Prince, but when they get deep into the cultural influence of that city and that area, most people are pretty surprised.
Well, it's something that I've been learning a lot about whilst transcribing the interviews from my podcast for this book. You know, and I've obviously done these interviews myself, and so I was there for the conversations when they took place. But when you revisit them and you transcribe them, and they're almost like it's almost a new interview because you're reading it as opposed to listening to it. And some of the kind of insights that I've been, you know, discovering that went perhaps unnoticed or slipped through the net the first time around have been giving me such an insight into American history and cultural history and underground music history. And I didn't even really know the extent to which there was a real thriving Minneapolis hardcore scene, wasn't there? And was that the scene which really kind of got you started on your whole life's, not just career trajectory, but, you know, personal journey as well? Did it all really begin in those kind of punk rock, hardcore, DIY basement shows in Minneapolis when you were a kid?
Absolutely. I mean, I was the youngest person of the people that I hung around with. Most of my friends were 5, 10, 12 years older than me. And because of that, I got dragged around to a lot of really amazing shows. I mean, I was When I look back on it now, it is really kind of remarkable that, at 14 years old, I was led into some of these places, but then, that older people in their 20s and early 30s didn't really think twice about having a 14, 15 year old hanging around. The social context of everything was what really brought me into all of that. I mean, in Minneapolis, you have a lot of different intersections. I mean, at that time, from my memory, you have all of the crust punk, profane existence people, and the intersections between that and what was going on in Scandinavia with black metal. All the crust punk, black metal stuff really crossed over. For me, I was in the early 90s. I was really into the what was burgeoning with the Amphetamine Reptile noise bands. But those were all bar bands. So I didn't really hang out drinking with people in bars so much. So I musically was a little bit more into the Lookout Records, melodic punk rock stuff.
A good friend of mine, actually, Ian Winwood is his name. He wrote an amazing book on the whole 90s American punk scene called Smash. It's got a longer title than that as the subtitle, but the main title, Smash, and it's all about that Lookout scene and then Epitaph and Fat Records and, you know, Bad Religion, Green Day, Offspring, etc., all those bands. I'm also reading Duff McKagan's book at the moment, It's So Easy, and a big kind of part in these, you know, localized scenes in all these cities was houses, wasn't it? Like punk houses that all had their own weird little names, their own almost micro universes. Tell me about the one which you were involved in. Perhaps you didn't live there, but you spent a lot of time there and went to shows there and stuff. The Scooby Don't House in Minneapolis. Tell me about this.
No, sure. I did live there.
You did? What age did you move there?
I want to say it was probably 15 years old.
Oh, wow.
15, maybe early 16. Memory's a little hazy, but I was definitely in my high school years. And so Scooby-Doo was a power pop punk band from Minneapolis that moved to Minneapolis from Wisconsin together as a band. And they rented an old Victorian house that was run down, 3525 First Avenue South, and did shows in their basement. And there were corn roasts in the back, and tons of amazing shows happened there. And as I started to get involved with that group and play with some other bands, their drummer, Matt Stokes, moved away suddenly.
Hold on, their drummer was called Matt Stokes.
Matt Stokes, yeah.
Man, that is,
if I remember right.
That is so close to me, sure it's crazy.
Exactly, yeah. I'm pretty sure that's Matt. He's gonna kill me if I get his last name wrong. But I remember Matt moving away to Oregon for some reason. I played drums in bands at the time, and Scooby Don't had a room to rent in their house, and B, they needed a drummer for an upcoming tour. So I did the two of them, and that tour was the Scooby Don't Dillinger 4 tour of summer 1994.
And 1994 was obviously the year that Dookie came out, Smash came out. Grunge had kind of dried up and punk rock was the new worldwide phenomenon, wasn't it? I mean, did that trickle down to the level of bands like you guys? And was that an incredibly exciting time? I mean, it would have been an exciting time at the age that you were at to be on the road touring and living that life anyway. But particularly in 94, when punk was like the in thing, did it make it especially, you know, exciting and amazing? And
well, it was definitely an exciting time. I mean, I was really into bands like Screeching Weasel, The Vindictives, a lot of the stuff that was happening in Chicago, Wine Press, the Meshuggahs, in addition to the California stuff that was happening. When Dookie came out, I wasn't that I was a snob about them going major or whatnot. I was a huge Jawbreaker fan when the Jawbreaker record came out on Geffen. I was really excited about that. So I don't remember being the type of fan that was upset about things moving like that. But I wasn't so involved with the greater scheme of things. I was really immersed in this world of basement living room shows and whatnot. I do remember on the on one of the Dookie Green Day tours, they were having Pansy Division open up, and we ended up inviting Pansy Division to play our basement, and everybody in the house got really excited because guys in Green Day might show up and play.
Amazing.
That's what I remember about from that time period. They never did.
Of course not.
But the Pansy Division show was amazing.
And the Queers came by and played that house as well, right? I love that band.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, the Queers. Yeah, Larry Livermore, the Potato Man. Other Lookout people that were in Bumble Scrump. There was a lot of crossover between that, the Grups. If you remember that band that was former members of Blatz. And, you know, a lot of that time segued. I mean, I mentioned it to you just because more and more getting involved with book publishing, I'm realizing, you know, that there aren't really a whole lot of people in publishing that, A, are interested in that social history, B, are knowledgeable enough to get involved. But, you know, it provides a bridge between telling the stories that can't be told. And that's really why, you know, we're involved in publishing, that we find value in doing it aside from trying to make a living and support our families and whatnot. But, you know, I think that's a unique perspective. And that's also something that I communicate a lot with authors, whether they're musicians or not, that, you know, if you have a particular experience and, you know, for lack of a better term, are an expert in a certain area, you'd be really surprised at how few people out there have the ability and the opportunity to tell that story.
Yeah. I think that the quest a lot of the time, and my show's a big kind of, I hope, a champion of that as well, is almost documenting, capturing, and trying to share these stories because they're not being, you know, given the platform to be read and heard about in more mainstream, even in, like, you know, the rock press. Most of the time, from a journalistic standpoint, the line of questioning is the same. It's, how's the tour? Tell us about the new record. And it's a promotional piece to sell, you know, either the upcoming run of shows that they have or the album which they have coming out. Whereas the interest for me is much more in documenting the history and the evolution. And that might be personally on an individual level, but then also the broader social context as well. And I also think that when you come from a punk background, I went to shows as a kid all the time as well. I think it instills in you, if you're a lifer, which some people are, I think you are, you clearly are, it instills in you an approach. So no matter what you do professionally, there's always this kind of DIY drive. And would you say that's something that you sort of took and ran with and has carried over, beginning in your obviously educational work, which then, you know, spiraled and splintered off into the publishing and book world that you entered? But would you say that all of that makeup and attitude and approach kind of all came from punk rock and the things that you saw and learned as a kid growing up in that scene?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, the older I get, the more I realize how much that has influenced me. You know, I mean, half the staff of our office comes from somewhat of a punk rock background, and just the DIY ethics. Sometimes that's something that we really struggle with communicating with authors and whatnot. People who don't have that background don't innately just go to certain mechanisms to market things or put things together. So yeah, I think that whole cultural influence is really important. It's been a big influence on us.
So what took you out to LA when you were 19? Did you finish high school? You said you kind of, you know, you're playing in drums in a punk band. You moved into a punk house at the age of 15. I'm assuming that school wasn't top of the list of priorities.
Well, I'm a book person first and foremost. I love learning. I actually love school. But I just became very disinterested and not challenged as a kid. That matched with all of the other exciting things that I was doing as a teenager. It just took over in a lot of ways. I had two high school teachers that really were supportive and liked what I was doing, that gave me credit, school credit, as I was touring around with bands. And in between touring with bands, I did a lot of hitchhiking by myself. I look back on all of that now and think it's absolutely insane.
Have you read the John Waters book, Tyson, where he breaks it into three chapters?
Oh, yeah.
And one's like his dream scenario of the hitchhiking across America. One's his nightmare. And then the third is the reality. Have you read that?
I have not read that. I've read a lot of John Waters over the years, but
I can't remember. You'll have to check it out. It's basically he decides, and it's fairly recently, you know, it was only maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago. He decided, however old I am, you know, it's either now or never. So I'm going to hitchhike across America. And I'm reading it and he's describing these scenarios and I'm thinking, fucking hell. And then it's only into like the fourth chapter that I realize these are clearly made up because they get more and more outrageous. And yeah, the way he presents it is the first third of the book is his dream kind of wish list scenarios. And then the second is his nightmarish visions of what might happen. And then the third and final installment is the reality of what actually went down. And he did indeed hitchhike across America. And wrote about his experiences. And as you say, it's something now which seems so far removed from today's world, doesn't it? And so crazy and dangerous and reckless. But, you know, not even that long ago, it was kind of quite a popular way, especially in your country, of getting out and seeing, you know, the world and experiencing life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're right. I mean, it seems absolutely crazy now, but it was more commonplace back then. I think, I mean, I don't really hang around with too many teenagers these days, aside from my buddies' kids and whatnot. So I don't know what the pulse is there, but yeah, it didn't seem crazy to me at the time, but yeah, I mean, later when I got into books and the book industry and whatnot, and authors like J.T. Leroy came out with trucker hitchhiking stories and whatnot. You know, those are the ones that really resonated and frightened me a great deal. I encountered a lot of weird stuff in those days, but I also think I skated by pretty safely compared to others.
Well, it's also about that similarity to the punk rock scene, isn't it? Is a lot of that would have been dangerous and scary and at the same time exciting. That's what sucks you in at a young age, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I never left my home in Minneapolis to hitchhike. You know, I always found myself on tour or traveling with an outfit or whatnot, and then paths cross and somehow I'm stranded in Tucson or somehow I'm in the middle of Montana with nowhere to go. And that's, you know, it's more of the mother of invention, which led me to do all that stuff. But, you know, I'd be terrified if my kids did that.
How did your parents feel about you moving out to LA? And did you go there purely and simply because of the cultural heritage of that city? So the rock and roll music, cinema, literature, was it just like a beacon of culture to you that pulled you out there? Obviously, you went to study at UCLA, but were you always going to go and study out in California, in Los Angeles, and get yourself out there?
Yeah, I mean, I came out to LA for school. To study ethnography at UCLA and in Cal State Northridge. you know, I've always liked it. I've had friendships and affinities with people in California. In 94, 95, I remember touring out here and playing a house party show with the band Real Big Fish.
I know them well. I've toured with those guys many times.
Well, there you go. We were like the first band on a five-band bill. I want to say just before they became really, really popular. But it was that trip. I do remember driving by the Sunset Strip tattoo parlor. And, you know, I've always been a big fan of LA street rock, hair metal, metal in general. So, you know, I knew these places just from the lore of being a fan of rock and roll. And it was really that trip that when I left, I felt like I was leaving home.
It's fascinating to me, the area of study. I'd never even heard of ethnography before. So can you break down that term for me, first of all? What is that the study of?
Sure. Yeah, it's really ethnogeography. And it's accepted in a lot of realms of science and education, but it's also contested because it uses a method of participant observation. You know, and in scientific communities, if you participate in what you're observing, you're poisoning the well, so to speak.
Yeah.
But that's really the beauty of it.
It's punk rock science.
And the history
you're
of
getting stuck in.
It is. It is, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, the history of it, I mean, you could classify Melville as ethnographic creative writing and whatnot. But really, the book that got me into it was this book by William H. White from the 40s called Life in an Italian Slum, where he broke down this neighborhood in New York and gave everybody nicknames and types and described this sub-community of people in such an interesting way. It's like a little time capsule. And then at the same time, I had the sociology professor who wrote this dissertation on high pressure auto sales in the San Fernando Valley in the 70s. And he had four volumes of work on reference in the library, about 2000 pages of great material, but it wasn't written like a novel. It was just written to document things. And it was insane. It was like working at these car dealerships on Van Nuys Boulevard, in the northern side of Los Angeles, talking about doing cocaine, blowing people off the lot, manipulation strategies, all these little things that were happening. And I just got so into that. And I remember talking to him after reading all four of those volumes, and he was surprised that I would even go that far and hold myself up in the library to do that. And he said, well, you know, find something you can immerse yourself in and just absorb it. And as I was driving around the days after that, I glimpsed a lot of the outdoor LA newsstands that are all over the place, and had an idea that that's where I wanted to do that stuff. And you know, what's interesting in this, I go into this with my own dissertation. It's called Where Particular People Congregate, an Ethnographic Study of the American Newsstand and Its People. The LA newsstand is really something unique. It isn't like a New York newsstand where people go there every day, get a paper, get some gum, whatever they're going to get, peck of cigarettes. It isn't like being in Japan where people do the same things. I assume there are similar elements in London. People hang out at these LA newsstands. Part of it, I think, is the weather, but, you know, I mean, it's not uncommon to see A-list celebrities talking for 2 or 3 hours with homeless people. And I just found that world so interesting and unique because the barriers are dropped.
It's almost,
you know, it's like its own reverted microcosm.
It's almost reverted back to that. It feels like a little bit now with this lockdown pandemic situation, because, you know, now there's nowhere to go. There's not these pubs, cafes, bars, restaurants. People are still out on the street, but there's nowhere for them to really congregate. So they are doing it outside shops and on road corners, and something which you traditionally never see. Like, usually if you're on a street, it's because you're on your way from A to B, and you're not just there to kind of hang out in the moment, in that spot, and just, as you say, drink in life and experience, you know, the culture of what's immediately around you. But I'm seeing a lot more of that now, and I find that fascinating, because as you say, it does away with all hierarchy and boundaries and barriers, and it just kind of puts everybody on this level playing field of just humans talking to other humans, doesn't it?
It does, and I love that. And I also loved the fact that, you know, there was a lot of just natural anonymity.
Yep.
I didn't realize this till later when I got involved with books, that a number of my regular newsstand customers, the ones that would at 3 o'clock in the morning bring me coffee, they would watch the newsstand while I went to use the restroom. Because in those newsstands, it's all, at least from my experience, it's paid under the table, piss in a cup, 10 hours, no break, all that kind of stuff. And so you really relied on your friends out there on the street to take care of things and help you out. And I was surprised that a number of those customers were notable authors, that it wasn't until I was doing book events later, when they walked in to an event and they were like, "What are you doing here? Why is the news guy working at the bookstore?"
It's throwing my whole world out of sync. I mean, what a fascinating segue. So you're studying and you decide to write this thesis, this dissertation on the activities and the kind of microcosms that surround these newsstands. So you're assumedly studying during the day and attending lectures during daylight. And then, you know, from whatever time of night until sunrise, you're either working at or hanging around and observing activity and people at newsstands. So basically the first question would be, when are you sleeping, or are you not?
I'm not. And it's funny, I was just reminiscing about this time period with somebody here at the office. But it's the you know, I was not sleeping very much, if ever.
Are you using anything to help you through the day in that sense?
nothing illicit.
Right,
but
right.
I was really, and I don't think they make this anymore, but, you know, at, you know, any 7-Eleven market or AM, PM in those days, you could buy, there was this like weightlifters drink. It was like a 16-ounce grape, strawberry, and when it was all natural, no sugar, and it had tons of ephedrine in it. And that was really one of my, aside from drinking a ton, gallons of coffee, that was the thing that really pushed me. And I probably slept, I mean, I had crashes, but on average, I would sleep maybe 40 minutes to 2 hours a day, mostly in my car between classes and working newsstand gigs and anything else I was doing.
So, you know, you're basically working around the clock. You assumedly graduate with flying colors, because this thesis sounds like you went all in and you committed to it. And I guess through the process of immersing yourself in this world, you then become fascinated by extension with the bookshop, the famous bookshop, Book Soup, that's on Sunset Strip. How do you wind up working at that store, and how do you make that segue from the newsstand guy that's observing these activities as a student to then ingraining himself into this world of, you know, literature and bookstores in Los Angeles?
Well, I made my way to Book Soup via the newsstand world. There was a newsstand owned by Book Soup connected to the store right on the outside called News Muse. And, I thought that would be a great extension of my research, you know, different clientele in that part of town. And there was a lot of interesting content, not a whole lot that ended up making it in the dissertation for whatever reason, but that led me to helping out with author events, and I quickly ended up becoming the marketing and publicity director of the store and hosting 1,000 events a year with presidents, celebrities, literary icons. Almost 9.5 years of doing that immersed me in the world of books and got me involved with a lot of publishers and authors. So when the owner of Book Soup died from pancreatic cancer in 2009 and the store was sold, that was my break. I was initially going to take a job with a major publisher in New York, but quickly got sucked back into just forming my own operation, which at the time was publishing select titles, but mostly doing marketing and design services for other publishers and authors and whatnot. I remember my first real season of Rare Bird. The roster of activities that we had were Chuck Palahniuk, Bret Easton Ellis, David Mamet, and Karl Rove.
Wow.
Among others. So that was like the first 5 months of the services side of things. And we had one novel.
And those guys are all giants at that time, right? Just like underground cultural literary icons.
They were, yeah. I mean, the reason I ended up working with those people right then is because I already had relationships with either the authors or the publishers prior to me leaving Book Soup. And when I left, a number of people in the industry were just wondering, okay, well, didn't we have plans for the spring? I thought we were going to do this big event. And that's a bit what motivated me to follow through with those obligations, aside from the fact that they were great and we could do really amazing things.
So the store itself, is that still there, but just under new ownership? And you say the owner passed away. Was it sudden? Was it unexpected? And were you then faced with the situation of, now I need to find a new job because this place is going to be bought out and my gig's gone?
Well, Glenn died in less than 4 weeks from diagnosis. So he died January 3rd, 2009. And it was really early December of the previous year that he was diagnosed. I remember a couple months before that, in October, he was complaining about his legs and what he thought were pulmonary embolisms. But it all happened really fast. And myself, the accountant, and Glenn were really the institutional knowledge of the store at the time. So it was a bit disruptive when that happened. And a few people stepped in to try and manage things. But for about 10, 11 months, it was kind of Lord of the Flies in certain ways. I mean, we ran the store as, people that were young.
It reminds me of that film Empire Records.
Totally.
But obviously in a bookstore instead.
Like that.
So you must have seen and experienced some amazing stuff just in that time alone.
Oh yeah. Oh no. I mean, I often describe it as the CBGBs of the book world. and that's how we described it then. I mean, we had staff sleeping over at the store because they were too hammered to go home. We had huge, iconic authors stopping by at 8 or 9 in the morning with bottles of Chivas to toast something or another. It was a really wild, wild time.
And you were aware in the moment that it was a special thing that you were a part of, because sometimes you don't know until afterwards, but you were aware in the moment, like, this is a very exciting time and place to be.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. And without exaggeration, a lot of the staff, especially in the marketing and publicity and events side, and this was a staff of a few dozen people, the biggest issue is that people didn't want to go home. So we were all always arguing with Glenn and other people that were running the store about who's on the clock and who's not, because, you know, people would work their allotted 8 hours or 40 hours in a week or whatnot, but then we'd have so many amazing authors coming through and so many crazy things happening, nobody would want to go home.
Tell me the Hunter S. Thompson story that I was just reading about in this article. It says, like, the article well, starts, it's like you, Johnny Depp, Sean Penn, Benicio del Toro, and Hunter S. Thompson are all in the store upstairs because Hunter's about to do a book launch event or a signing, right?
Well, I'll tell some stories, but the, you know, this definitely needs a disclaimer. When that article was written, a lot of the stories were distorted in a number of ways. I mean, right. I look back at it now, it's great lore. You know, a lot of it was heightened. It ended up being the cover story of the LA Weekly at the time.
Wow.
The intent was actually to profile 5, 6, or 7 independent bookstores in Los Angeles. And our story, it ended up being just so crazy with celebrity things and wacky times that it just ended up being a little bit more salacious, but there were definitely liberties taken by the journalist. Certain things that definitely got me into hot water, but ultimately, you know, it is what it is. The Hunter S. Thompson stuff is really interesting to me because that was, I think, October 18th, 2004. And it was 3 months before Hunter shot himself. And it was kind of like his last hurrah in a lot of ways. His book was about sports journalism or sports columns, which I'm not really a big sports person, so I didn't read it at the time. But the that whole scene was just a full entourage roaming around town. I mean, I experienced it from the LA spot of the tour, but later when we worked with Sean Penn, I got to hear some of the other stories from the Times, like when they were in New Orleans and whatnot. And it was crazy, you know, it was just absolute mayhem. But, you know, Hunter, from my memory, was very, very much in pain. I remember his leg being in serious pain, and very similar to when we had Hulk Hogan at the store. And, you know, both of them just kind of had the same thing. When people were around them, they were exactly what you'd expect them to be. Lively, the caricatures of themselves. And then when people would leave, they would just deflate. Like their energy would just dissipate completely.
It's heartbreaking when you hear stuff like that, isn't it? That they put so much of themselves into pleasing and performing and entertaining others. And then, as you say, when the crowd's gone, they're just so exhausted. They just crash and collapse. And I mean, what an exhausting, tiring way to live your life.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I can't even imagine it. But, you know, I've obviously, like everybody else, you know, heart went out to Hunter's family and all the people around him. And I was a lot younger then. I'm really disappointed that I didn't get to take him up on his offer to go out to Woody Creek.
Oh, man, he did invite you out there, did he?
He invited the whole store.
I've been to Ralph's house. I've been to Ralph Steadman's house. I went down there and recorded a podcast with him, and he opened up his studio, and he, you know, took me through all the years worth of work that he's done pre-Hunter, with Hunter, after Hunter. And, you know, he's pretty old now as well, and he wasn't the most engaged interviewee, I think, because he's just so old and over it. But he was very sweet and very accommodating and really funny. And I think the bit that he enjoyed the most actually was doing the photo shoot with me. He really started playing up then. You sort of saw this youthful energy coming out of him. But it was cool as well. If you have heard it, that music, the song that he plays in the in the podcast that I left in, and it's this long and low, and it's this track that he's recorded with recordings from Hunter in the song, like stuff like that. For me, I mean, Hunter has always been my favorite writer, and he's the reason really why I probably studied literature at university and fell in love with storytelling, is really because of him. I'm jealous that you got to meet him and spend time with him and with Sean and Johnny and all that. So what's the Sean Penn connection then? Obviously Johnny Depp and Benicio would have been in the film, which I'm sure would have been around that time perhaps, or was this a little bit after the film?
Right. Well, there isn't a connection between Hunter and why we later published the Sean Penn book, but
he was on that book tour with Hunter, you were saying.
Yeah, but you know, I remember years later. This was maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago when I got a call from Sean's agent about his first book that we were going to publish initially, before another publisher came in with more money and more attractive offer. But, I met with Sean in Malibu, and, you know, one of the first things I said was, you know, hey, we had, you know, I remember meeting you, with Hunter. I remember meeting you with, Christopher Hitchens, and, he nodded, but I don't think, you know, he remembered that interaction that I hold in such high regard. But I think Sean has heard from a number of people that we had a particular operation going on that might be right for his project. And I think we're probably the perfect publisher for him. In a number of ways, we have another book with him that will happen hopefully in the next year or two. And
is that another Bob Hunter one? Is it the third installment of this series that he's been doing, or is it something separate?
Well, it's a visual book. So
there you go.
It's a visual book with a lot of the Bob Hunter stuff and, you know, it's really up to Sean to decide what he ultimately wants to put in. But, when we got together that first time over brunch and talked about what he wanted to do with everything, and, you know, that's where I remember bringing up initially that there should be a visual component, because he had all these amazing stories about how while he was writing, aside from walking around laughing at his own jokes, which is what I think every writer should do. He was doing these paintings and these collage pieces, these mixed media pieces. And I could tell immediately that they were aiding the creative process, and it needs to be a part of it.
Do you know why he was in a room with Hunter and Depp then? Why Sean himself was there? Was he just, you know, a fan and a friend of Hunter? Was that what put him in that room at Book Soup?
Yeah, I don't think I've heard from him on how they met, but you know, Sean has been a lot of places and done a lot of things, but ultimately one of the things that I respect about him is that he has a really powerful curiosity with him. He respects creative process. He is intrigued by people who create things. And I think deep down, like himself, I mean, he just wants to get into the minds of other people and experience things. But, you know, I think once they became buddies, he really loved and respected him. I think I mentioned to you recently about the time this past September when we were on Sean Penn's book tour. And we were in New York driving around after the event with Paul Theroux at the 92nd Street Y. And we were just bumming around, having a good time. And Sean said, wait, back up. And we backed up about 100 feet or so. And sitting at one of these classic New York pizza places where you grab a slice and sit facing the street was this guy that looked exactly like Hunter S. Thompson, but wasn't. I mean, it wasn't as if he was in a Halloween costume or anything. He just looked exactly like him. And we were all in like an Escalade or something like that. And we stopped for a while, a few, like 2 minutes or so. And finally, we ended up rolling down the window and Sean yelled out, Hunter! And then we tear it off like teenagers.
He seems like he's a fun guy as well. Like, I think he's one of those people who gets a bad rep in the media because he's obviously very political and very engaged with activism and that kind of stuff. And I think he's maybe perceived to be a bit pretentious and serious and uptight. But actually, from the few things that I've heard, and certainly having read his book, and his book's amazing, not the ones that he's written, but there's a book about him that's told through the eyes of all his actor buddies and creative friends. So it's people like Woody Harrelson and Dennis Hopper and Jack Nicholson, and they're all talking about Sean. And it seems like he's, you know, he's partial to having a good time. He's got a good sense of humor. He seems like he's, you know, a very kind of like witty, funny dude.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love people who can go back and forth between those two sides, you know, be really funny and life of the party type person to being someone who can take things really seriously. I mean, people that can change just on a dime are people that I really, you know, that's a level of depth that I think is really hard to balance. And people that can do it are pretty fascinating.
I'm with you on that. That's my favorite kind of person as well. Complicated, contradictory, multi-layered. The dream guests and the dream people that I want to be surrounded with. I love it.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
So we're going to talk about Rare Bird now in more detail and, you know, what you've been sort of up to with that imprint and some notable releases over the years and then things coming up. Before we do, though, whilst all this is going on, Tyson, alongside your, you know, leap into the literary world, you still very much keep your feet anchored in the rock and roll world, don't you? And when you move to LA, you're doing music out there as well. You're playing in bands and you're keeping active and connected and integrated within all that world as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, creatively, I'm a musician. That's how I think. When I'm working with authors, on their projects, I'm often using metaphoric language that comes from being a musician. Like, you know, if a manuscript is sloppy, I'll say, you know, I'm not going to go into the studio expecting somebody else is going to tune my guitar. And those analogies, you know, I think are pretty important, but that, you know, I mean, that's really how I think from a creative point of view. I'm a book person first and foremost, but, you know, I love playing music. That's my outlet, especially in lockdown. You know, I've been working on a lot of material in between working on audiobooks and other things. And, you know, that's what keeps me sane. But it also, I think, provides a bridge between working with music people. You know, there are great people in book publishing that are musicians and great fans of music, but, you know, there are a lot more people that aren't.
Well, I've spoke to a couple of people, not, you know, I haven't gone to them to talk specifically about you, but when I've mentioned that I'm doing this, or they've seen that I'm doing this, or they've heard, Joe Cardamone was somebody who messaged me the other day, and he saw that I'd announced about my book, and he's like, amazing, congratulations. He's like, I know Tyson, he's a really good dude. And that seems to be, I'm not just saying this to make you feel good about yourself, but you should know it. Everybody that I've spoken to within the music community seems to have like real respect for you. And I guess that's because they can see that you're authentic and you care, and you know, you're one of them. You're one of us. One of the good guys.
That's really good to hear. Yeah, I love Joe. We're working on a pretty amazing project that we're not ready to announce yet, but when we do, I think it'll be earth-shattering. Yeah, we're almost the same age. I forget what month he was born in, but we're very close. We've become, I think, pretty good buddies over the last number of years, and you know, just one of those guys where I feel like I've known him my whole life. So.
I just transcribed my interview with him yesterday, actually, so it's fresh in my head, and I'd forgotten really how deep we went in with that one. I don't know whether you've heard that one yet, but it was a very revealing and insightful and quite moving conversation. Mm-hmm. There's some really good bits in that that are going to be going into my book, but we'll get to that. So you nearly played Ricky Rackman's Cat House, the grand sort of reopening of that famous sleazy Hollywood rock and roll club, but the date that you were set to play that was the 9th of September in 2001. So for obvious reasons, it didn't happen. What's your memory from that day being out west in America?
Well, in a few months earlier, in June of 2001, that's when I put together this band with a couple other buddies, Eric Stacey, who's the bass player in Faster Pussycat, this guy, Stacey Blades, who was driving out from Florida to LA, coming from this band Rocks Gang with two X's. And at
obviously,
the time we didn't have a drummer. And then we recruited Vic Fox with, I think, two K's.
Yep. very Motley Crue, isn't it?
And I was like this, I don't know how old I was, 19, something like that. And we were, it was kind of like, you know, those guys were cutting their hair and getting a little bit more Hanoi Rocks, Backyard Babies style influence stuff, trying to get away from their hair metal stigmas. And it was at the same time that Ricky was trying to resurrect the Cat House. And this was at a pretty small place on El Centro in Melrose in Los Angeles. And, it was going to be a big opening. And I remember being very excited. I mean, this is like a dream come true for me in a lot of ways. I'm playing with all these rocker guys that were older than me that I, liked their music, knew who they were. And here I was kind of like the kid in a candy store. And I remember, waking up that morning with my mother calling me saying, you got to turn on the news, and thinking it was absolutely nuts. But it didn't occur to me that the world was going to change so quickly. I was pretty surprised, to be really honest with you. And I think I was just in shock. As a participant of what was happening in the world. When Ricky called it off, I remember thinking, what? That's 3,000 miles away, and not really naively understanding the seriousness of everything. But Ricky ended up rescheduling, and we did play the Cat House.
You did get to do it then.
For Tough. Yeah. Opening. I think we opened for Tough with two F's. You remember that band?
And then
three or four months later we toured Japan, and that was just kind of an amazing time for me.
I've never been to Japan. I really want to go there someday. It just seems like it's just an alien world, in every sense, culturally, just in terms of its layout. You look at Tokyo, it just looks like, something out of Blade Runner. It looks like such a wonderfully weird and amazing place. And I do hope to go there someday soon when the world is allowed to travel freely once again. So Rare Birds, where does the name come from? Is this entirely your brainchild?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story. Back in the Book Soup days, there were a lot of jokes and just things that we would talk about. One of which was, and at the time I had started to grow this beard, that was very ginger. And I would joke that, I wanted to start my own bookstore called Redbeard's Rare Bird Bookstore.
There you go. Love it.
And then we were doing a last event, which I think I mentioned to you that we did a lot of them back in those days, for iconic authors. We did their last events, and one of them was John Updike. And I was hanging out with him backstage at the event, signing books, having a blast. One of my favorite books of all time is Rabbit is Rich. And I have all these passages underlined and all these questions for him while we were signing 1,000 books or whatever it was. And my colleague ended up telling him that, or mentioning the Redbeard's Rare Bird Bookstore idea. And he said that, that sounds like a great name for a bookstore, but whatever you do after Book Soup, you should incorporate that. And so when I left the bookstore, started to do my other things, and it came down to naming the company, it just seemed like a no-brainer.
I think it's just a really cool name as well that sums up, what the whole kind of identity of the publishing house is all about. You've mentioned a few books which you've put out already, notable ones. I guess let's focus in on the music orientated books, because I guess for the large part, people who are listening to this will be more familiar with perhaps the musicians and the musical figures. So what have been some of the standout releases for you over the last few years that have, been really proud achievements for you to work with and have come out really well and done really well and been well received?
Oh, well, there are so many, and I know no matter how many I list, I'm going to miss something crucial and somebody might possibly get upset. I mean, we publish a book a week.
Yeah. You told me that the other day. I couldn't believe it, but that's kind of standard, is it?
It is, yeah. We've published approximately 50 books a year for more years than we've been in business now, I think. Early on it was, we did this memoir by the Dead Kennedys drummer, D.H. Peligro, that I was really into. Both of the Keith Buckley novels, Watch and Scale, as far as music is concerned. We have this new book by Chris Barrows of the punk band The Pink Lincolns called Cheap Shots. That's all this amazing photography from maybe the late 70s, definitely the early 80s until today, where he would take disposable cameras to shows. And I mean, it's a lot of punk bands, lots of Black Flag, Descendants, Cramps, Iggy and the Stooges, but it also has some really interesting photographs of like U2 in front of 30 people on their first tour. And the fact that Chris Barrows lives in Florida and shot the majority of these photographs there, it's just a really interesting perspective. I mean, a lot of time you see these punk rock photo books where it's New York, LA, London, wherever.
Yeah.
And you definitely see the bands acting differently in a B or a C tier city.
You're 100% right.
You know, you have the bad brains playing basketball, and you know, it's just like he befriended so many great people that, you know, if that was happening in Chicago or San Francisco, I don't think Chris would have had the opportunity.
Well, all the tours that I've done, and I've done about a dozen now, you see how bands act differently in, as you say, the major cities, the New Yorks, the Londons, the LAs, because they know the industry are going to be there. There's pressure. They've also got a lot of friends there. The guest lists are always massive. They're distracted. They're stressed. And then when you get out to, like, as you say, one of these B or C towns, they're so much more natural and at ease. And if you're a journalist or a photographer or any of those kind of people, and you're trying to capture or document an authentic moment with these people, then it's always much better to do it outside of the major cities. That's kind of actually why I, when I launched my podcast initially, I moved back home with my mum in Birmingham. Part of that was financially, because I had to kind of, you know, save on not paying rent whilst I was getting the show off the ground. But another part of it was I wasn't up against any of the other journalists for time, so I could get the 60 minutes that I wanted with a lot of the guests. Mm-hmm. And then also you're just getting them when they're a bit more natural and at ease in my hometown city, which was outside of the kind of the media pond of London. And I benefited so much from that for so long. So I can absolutely see from a photography point of view how being out somewhere like, you know, removed, such as Florida, would allow you to capture, as you say, something which you just wouldn't see in one of those other cities, and the bands themselves acting in a way that they wouldn't act. That sounds amazing. I love visual books as well. I really love photography books or mixtures of the two, you know, whether they tell the stories behind the shots or it's just the shots. And then there's a couple that aren't out yet, but can we talk about the one of my favorite, I've never met him, but he just seems like the most bizarre and brilliant individual and character in music, Flacke from Rammstein, has always fascinated me. And you've got a book coming out by him. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is long in the works. 2.5 years ago or so, this memoir was published in German to wide acclaim. And we acquired it for translation, and it would have come out a lot sooner, but we just ran into so many problems with the actual translation. We went through 3 translators, and it's a pretty big book. It's like 140,000 words. And it ended up coinciding beautifully with the new stuff that Rammstein is doing. You know, it's unfortunate that their European and North American tours are postponed, but I do think they're going to happen, and it seems like they're in a great position now. But yeah, this will be the first English translation of this remarkable story, and it'll come out early fall, late summer. Right now, we are doing a vinyl audiobook with another amazing musician narrating the Flacke excerpts, and it's just really exciting. And you know, to be completely honest, when Rammstein was at their beginning stages of putting out records and being on charts and being popular, I of course knew who they were and heard them on the radio, but I never really followed them. I didn't buy any of the records. I wasn't that familiar, but now that I'm immersed in it, I'm just blown away that, I mean, they're like a Brechtian circus traveling around the world, and it's pretty remarkable. I'm impressed.
The documentary on them, Made in America, is amazing. And you should, I'm going to link you up via email with a good friend of mine called Dante Benuto. I'm not sure whether you know Dante or not already. You should listen to the podcast episode I did with him, but he's head of A&R at Spine Farm Records. And he's the guy that signed Rammstein in the UK many moons ago when nobody would touch them. And he brought them over here for the first time. And there's so many amazing stories that he's got because he's been with them since day one. And he works with Till on his solo stuff as well. And he's one of the few people I think that's kind of been with that band since day one. And he's a dear friend. And like yourself, he's somebody that really recognizes the specialness. Well, everybody now recognizes the unique talent and, you know, brilliance of Rammstein, but he was probably the first person outside of Germany to really see it. And he's been a big champion of them ever since. So, yeah, he's definitely someone that you should get to know. And then the other one, a mutual, again, connection between myself and yourself. We'll talk about Keith in a moment as well, because we have to. Jesse Hughes, old Jesse, Boots Electric, the weird, wild man that he is. You've been working with him for quite some time, I believe, on a special project. Can we talk to any extent about that? And do you have any idea as to when that might be seeing the light of day?
We have been working on stuff. I don't think details are ready to release yet. But yeah, I mean, the biggest problem with Jesse over the years has been too many ideas, which has been great. And, ultimately we've decided to stick to what will probably be more of a traditional autobiography or memoir. But I hope that we get to do some of the other crazy ideas as well. And, you know, I mean, Jesse is getting to know him. He's a really interesting character. I mean, throughout the years, we've had so many mutual people in common, but it was a roadie buddy who put us in touch and invited me over to Jesse's place in the middle of the night with craziness ensuing.
no doubt.
After a number of those meetings, I think there's a lot of no matter who it is, I mean, celebrity or not, there is what we describe as, make sure they're relatively sane.
Yeah, relative being the key word.
They could be sane or insane, but reading between the lines, that's, can we work with it? And, and if not, is it worth going down that road? But yeah, I really think that he has a unique story to tell. And even though a lot has been told and there have been multiple documentaries going into detail, I think there's a side to Jesse that a lot of people don't see. That,
yeah,
I think he wants to share it. I think people, for better or worse, would like to be clued into that world. And I hope that he, continues to be motivated in creating, because he's a remarkably talented person.
He's just a supremely, insanely intelligent individual as well. And such an encyclopedia of music. Like, he's a genuine professor of rock and roll, and he knows so much about so much. And he's a real kind of, historian in so many ways of rock and roll, and really like an interestingly kind of sensitive, sweet, genuine person behind the kind of two-dimensional character that he projects out into the world, which I've seen glances of over the years and gotten to know. And yeah, I think obviously with all of the awful stuff that happened with Paris, that's unfortunately overshadowed a lot of the other, great qualities. And as you say, interesting details to that man's life and his story. The Colin Hanks documentary Mon Ami was incredible, and that did explore a lot of the Eagles' backstory as well. But as you say, there's so much more to Jesse that so few people outside of his circles, I think, have ever really seen. So that's something I look forward to for sure. So the reason we got connected in the first place is because of Keith, and I want to give him a huge shout out here on the show and just thank him publicly for being the best. And I have interviewed him a few times over the years. He's always been just I don't know, real. Like, there's real and then there's Keith Buckley real. And he is one of the most stand-up people I've met in music. Like, what you see is what you get. If he says something, he means it. And we did a great live Q&A together last summer. After that, we sat down and had a few drinks in a bar up the road. And we were talking about how we were going to do loads more. That's still the plan. Hopefully, you know, one day when shows are a thing again, we can look into exploring those avenues. But a big focus of the Q&A was the books, because I knew that people who were coming would, you know, have heard a lot of the musical anecdotes many times before, although we did try and uncover some new stuff as well. So I read both the books in the lead up to that live Q&A, Scale and Watch, and just thoroughly enjoyed both of them. Thought he was such a gifted writer, such a great storyteller. How did that initial, was Scale first?
Yeah. Scale came out first.
How did Scale come about? How did you two meet, and how did that first book come about?
I got a call from one of our authors, John Albert, who also was the marketing guy at Epitaph Anti. And he said, hey, Tyson, I know this sounds kind of lame, but I got a musician that's on the roster. He's cool, don't worry. But, you know, he's got, I think, a novel. You're not obligated, of course, but, you know, if you want to talk to him. And he did. And the same thing that happened with Joe Cardamone. You know, once I started talking to Keith, it was really like somebody I grew up with. We're similar in age, have different paths in life, but, you know, I mean, you just meet those people that you connect with, and you don't necessarily feel like you need to explain a whole lot. You just get each other. And I felt that way about Keith. I hope he feels that way about me. But most importantly, the work material, once I started to read it, it's exactly what I initially envisioned publishing with Rare Bird. I mean, just the intersections of great real voice, which is extremely hard to do. And, you know, regardless of what the narrative and what the story is, somebody that you wanted to just keep on reading. And among many other attributes, that's one of the things that really intrigues me about Keith's output. I think that carries over into the music and in his lyrics and just his personality. You know, he's just a guy that if he was reading the phone book, you'd want to listen to it.
Yeah, and just a real kind of warmth to his personality. You can see that it's there, and it's, I don't know, it's just somebody that you want to hang out with and spend time with. He's a really good dude. So thank you, Keith. So I want to ask you from a, I hope it doesn't sound egotistical, but just out of a more curious point of view, what was the initial thoughts when you heard the show, which was the show that I did with Keith, the first thing that you heard from my podcast output, assumedly that was, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I was tipped off to the podcast because Keith was on it. You know, I don't want to sound out of the loop, but that was the first time that I'd heard of it. And I couldn't stop listening. Thankfully, you have episodes galore by that time.
Yeah.
And I could just listen and I loved it. And so when you and I ended up meeting, you know, I kind of felt like I already knew you. You didn't know me, but I'd already listened to hours and hours and hours of your voice. And
oh, you'd heard that many, had you? Wow.
Oh, no. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if by the time I met you in London, I'd listened to 50 podcasts.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I would have just presumed that you'd have maybe just heard, because you listed off a few people in the email to me of, you know, people like Joe, Keith, Jesse, either people that you've, you know, previously worked with or working with or about to put something out with. And so I presumed maybe he just dipped in on the ones that, you know, there's mutual connections there.
I'm a genuine fan. And, you know, I thought it was extra cool that you responded right away, would meet on a few days notice at best, and on your birthday.
On my birthday.
I remember that.
Yeah.
And the same day that we were hours later going to see Brian Ferry at Royal Albert Hall, which was amazing.
Yeah, the last concert I saw, I'm assuming that's the same with you.
Same with me.
Yeah. And then it was the next week that the world shut down. I mean, it's wild, isn't it? That seems like another lifetime ago now.
Well, we were supposed to go to Paris 2 days later for some meetings and then fly back home from there. But really within hours of us, or hours of the show, in the middle of the night, you know, because the travel ban was announced, and I just felt uncomfortable having myself and an employee possibly quarantined for weeks in a different country. We flew back immediately, and it was so strange because, at that time, I mean, I was expecting airports to be insane and just crowded. They were dead. Our flight nobody was panicking. We got home just before all the craziness started happening, and I'm very thankful for that.
How long do you think it'll be before people are allowed to fly into Los Angeles, if you had to kind of take a rough guess? Do you know?
Well, I haven't been following the travel news, but I have had a couple authors fly in and out. So I know flights are happening. Maybe they aren't internationally, but you know, I had an author fly back to New York from LA recently. So
there you go.
They said it was great. You know, you get two rows to yourself and coach.
Yeah, I'll bet. Sprawl out, reach out your legs. I've been cooking up some insane ideas for a book launch thing, because my friend books the bands at the Viper Room. So he's got free reign of that venue.
That's amazing. It's funny you mentioned that, because, you know, the Viper Room, I mean, that whole crew is very close to us, because the Viper Room is a block away from Book Soup.
No way. So do you know Jeff Fioretti? Do you know Jeff?
Of course.
Yeah, so Jeff's a dear friend of mine. I've stayed at his house a lot when I'm out in Los Angeles.
Well,
that's my guy.
I'll send you some pictures that you'll probably be amused at. No, love Jeff to death. Also, my buddy Joe Mazzacapa from Lady Sinatra ran the door for many, many years. And our other author, Jason Christopher.
Right.
He goes, I think his cousin opened up the Viper Room with another celebrity. But that, you know, just being right next to the bookstore world. I mean, I went to the Viper Room after work five nights a week.
Amazing. Well, that's absolutely where we should throw some kind of shindig to celebrate this thing.
If it's still there. I mean, they, I don't know what's happening, but development is redoing that whole block. I hope it's still there.
Well, we can dream. I've still got a book to write in the meantime anyway. It's coming along well, boss. You'll be pleased to know. We'll talk about a few things relating to the book off air. Obviously, we don't want to now just go into a business meeting in the podcast. but I wanted to take a moment to say thank you to you on here, so that everybody who listens to my show can hear how grateful I am to you for giving me this opportunity. I don't think if you hadn't have come along and presented such an amazing and exciting opportunity to me, then I would have been motivated in the way that I have been to develop this project. A friend of mine who's a musician said to me about a year ago now, he was like, you should turn the show into a book. It would be a really good thing to do, because he was just putting out a book at that time. And I was like, yeah, but because I didn't have anybody interested in it, I didn't really have that motivation. And it's such a massive undertaking because there are so many episodes. You know, I've just been drowning in transcriptions for days now. And luckily I enjoy it because it's a fun thing. But yeah, I think I kind of just always thought, yeah, that would be a good thing to do, but I was never motivated to really make it happen. And then after meeting you and you kind of, you know, saying, I love the show, I think it would make a great book, I'm interested in working with you on it. That's really kind of put a rocket up my ass and got me into gear to make this a thing, and giving me the opportunity, especially at this point in time, has been a godsend. So I'm really grateful, and I want to say thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Matt. I mean, it, from my perspective, as a person that is always on the lookout for great and viable books to do, it's really a no-brainer. I mean, I think it fits perfectly. And I hope this is the beginning of obviously multiple volumes, but I hope, you know, you have a great experience to the point where you want to do more books, maybe not just podcast related books, but other things.
Amen. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm already cooking up a few ideas in the back of my brain, as I tend to do once I get started and get excited. It's like, right, I'm off. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat today as well. I know it's quite thank early you. Over there where you are. This is the start of your day. So hopefully it's been quite a nice, you know, mental exercise to go all the way back down memory lane and relive your life in 90 minutes.
No, it's great. It's great. I'm halfway through my day over here. I'm one of those crazy people that wakes up at 4 o'clock in the morning without an alarm and just wants to go.
I was amazed at that when we had a toast the other week to the deal, and it was about 8 a.m. your time, and you're like, yeah, this is pretty much my 5 p.m. I've smashed out a day's work.
I'm usually really, by this time, jumping on calls, I'm really wired on lots of coffee, and for the people that are just waking up, you know, it can be odd sometimes.
What song should we play out with? I'm going to surprise you with a song to start the show. I like to play, obviously, little 30-second snippets. How would you like to go out, Tyson? I'm just springing this on you as well, so I apologize for the curveball, but I thought I would ask you in the moment, and then whatever comes to mind, we can play out with that. But yeah, my book is available for pre-order now, so if people are listening to this, want to get on that, there's a link in all the bios on my social media pages, so Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can also just Google Rare Bird Life in the Stocks, or go onto rarebirdlit.com and find it on there. And until June the 16th, you can get 20% off by typing in the promo code RB for Rare Bird, RB Devotee 2020. So yeah, please get those pre-orders in and make me look good for Tyson, so he wants to do more books with me. That's, I've just bought you some time then, so you should have a nice track up your sleeve now, Tyson. What are we going to play out with?
Oh yeah, I didn't need to think about it. What I've had in my head since you and I last saw each other was a Thrill of It All.
Amazing.
I mean, that moment from the show when all the old people rushed the stage. No offense, but that was really a brilliant moment.
Mate, what a great talk. Thanks so much for everything.
Likewise.
And here's to the future, dude.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.